And welcome back. Thanks for being here. This is the second hour with the Noura Gadgada. So we are talking about the paleo diet, health, foods, and of course the issues of stress and everything else, fatigue and your adrenal glands, and what you can begin to do about these issues overall. And it's very easy to, of course, get overwhelmed by all the different factors that play into this. But I think a good point you mentioned earlier has to do with how we react to these kinds of things, how we actually mentally deal with some of these issues and the stress. Because I mean, I've experimented a good deal on myself actually, to try to figure out what worked. I took no one's word for it, and I wanted to try it for myself. So I did the vegetarian thing for a few years. I did the vegan thing after that, and you know, I've been through a lot of different methods and tried different things, and I know what works and what doesn't, at least when it comes to my own body. You know, and I can tell you that I lost way too much muscle mass. I got emaciated, and yes, it did feel great for a while, specifically in the beginning. I believe that there is a detox period and such.
Absolutely.
That I recommend that people actually do regularly now and then. This is something that you need to go. It's kind of like a fasting a little bit. It's like you said, we didn't have access to food all the times, but in the long run, of course, this is something that I noticed the detrimental effects of. And now I've gone in the complete opposite direction for many years now. But I know what's working. I've, you know, managed to build up my weight again and get more muscle and everything else. So, but what I was curious about this as well is how you think this actually affects your thinking and your brain. If this is something, I mean, you mentioned, I know that's maybe more related to stress issue by itself, but I think a lot of parts of this problem is as well that people have a tendency to shut down and actually not manage to focus on a lot of the problems that we are faced with. Because bodily, physiologically, we're already under so much stress and pressure. What would you say about this, Noura?
Well, what I say about that is we have really no room for error anymore in terms of what we need to do in order to maintain some semblance of health, much less to attempt to achieve anything resembling optimal health. You know, our brains are made up of virtually 80% fat. And they're made up of the very fats that we supply the brain with in our diet. This is how we evolved, is relying on fat as a primary source of fuel. That's what we're designed to do. And so, this is change. You know, we had this tremendous shift, 10,000 years ago, as I mentioned, from a diet that was roughly 90% based in animal source foods, and then the rest whatever we could forage, given whatever was climatically or seasonally available to us, or what we were technologically capable of processing and making edible, because wild plants, as some people realize, are quite a bit more toxic than many of the ones that we have domesticated. And there's still anti-nutrients in many domesticated animal, or rather plant, products, but it's, you know, they're easier for us to handle than they perhaps used to be. And plant foods would never really have supplied us with any meaningful, really source of calories, particularly.
Yeah.
It just, you know, if you take a wild edible plant class, which I'm into that sort of stuff, I'm not saying nobody should be eating plant foods. I actually think plant-based foods, you know, fibrous vegetables and greens, in other words, are probably more important to us now than they ever used to be during our long evolutionary history, because they have a detoxifying effect upon us.
Exactly.
And they also contain a lot of antioxidants and phytonutrients that I think we need to help us combat the toxic environment we live in. But they cannot supply us with the incredible range of nutrients that we need as humans in order to maintain and rebuild and regenerate our bodies, and especially our brains. Our brains need an enormous amount of fat in order to optimally function. And all even Neolithically, you know, where we have hunter-gatherer types of tribes that were still thriving in post-agricultural revolution, but they were still doing a hunter-gatherer thing. So we could actually look at what they were doing. Dietary fat, even among Neolithic cultures, always played a central role in their diets, because, you know, fat to our physiological makeup as creatures of the Ice Age means survival, and survival literally trumps everything else. And not just fat, but the fat soluble nutrient and the essential fatty acids supplied by these things that are uniquely responsible for building the human brain. You know, if it's not in our diets, it's not in our brain. And so we have to supply our brain with quality natural source fat on an ongoing basis. And I'm not talking about vegetable oil. I'm talking about animal source fats from naturally fed sources, animals that have been fed on nothing but fresh green grass and wild plant foods, you know, foods that would have been considered natural to them.
Well, exactly. That's the other big part of this. What are the animals getting fed that we eat, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that's something I wish we'd talked about in the previous hour, because the one form of meat eating is sustainable while the other form clearly is not. And I have no argument with vegetarians and vegans that say that feedlot meat is destroying the planet. Absolutely. That is not a sustainable way of doing things. It's not a healthy way of doing things. But I don't know if you're familiar with Alan Savory or not.
No, I'm not.
Oh, boy. So he did one of the biggest and top, he was like in the top 10 of the best TED Talks of last year. He's from the Savory Institute in Zimbabwe. And what he's done is he has created a method of what he calls holistic management of that allows for the restoration of, for instance, of healthy watersheds, the reversal of global desertification, which is happening at an alarming rate now over almost 2/3 of the landmass.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And also, you know, while also feeding, you know, vast human populations and restoring natural systems, all through the use, through the application of natural systems using grazing animals. Because it turns out that, you know, grasslands and herbivores or rather ruminants co-evolved. And if you take the ruminants off the grasslands die. And what we've done since we started domesticating animals is we remove them from these natural systems where there were thundering herds of, you know, sometimes hundreds of thousands of animals in a single, you know, herd across the African plain and across, you know, the Western plains of the United States and other places in the world. We took them out of those big herds, and we started to kind of stuff them into confined areas and where they would just sort of trample everything in a single spot. We removed them from the influence of their predators, and we killed off their predators, and we began feeding them foods that were unnatural to them.
Yeah.
Which is what we do with domesticated animals. And as a result, of course, when animals are managed in that way, it can be detrimental to the land. But if you take and you go back and you try to mimic what these animals would be doing naturally in the wild, and it's, again, the process is called holistic management, and it's being exercised now on every continent in the world to some degree or another. Mm. The results are mind-blowing. You can see before and after pictures of terrain where on one picture it looks like a lunar landscape, just a few sprigs of grass popping up and things just, you know, no water anywhere. It looks like, you know, cracked ground and whatever. And a few seasons later, you have this lush environment with water flowing through it that looks completely different. And the climate didn't change. What changed was the way the land was managed. And 2/3 of the landmass of the planet is not appropriate to agricultural implementation. It just simply isn't. You have desert, you have areas where there's nothing but, or it's mountainous and there's nothing but scrub brush and poor soils that cannot be applied to agriculture. But there are tons of animals that can thrive in those environments if they are properly managed. And restore stability to the climate in those areas, because when you have, you know, the bare ground of an area that's experiencing desertification, you have greater heat during the day and greater cold at night, and those differences can impact, you know, climate in these vast areas. So you can sort of you can restore even and even possibly modify what we're thinking of as climate change right now by applying some of these principles as well. Again, while restoring the health of the soil.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, you know.
It is. It's absolutely huge. And also all of this while feeding vast human populations that are currently starving. Are we going to be throwing bags of rice at these people? Are we going to be restoring their dignity by you know, restoring healthy grazing animals and in a natural way to the land that allows these people to be able to sustain themselves? You know, organizations like Heifer International, I think, are doing some of the best work toward restoring human self-sufficiency and self-reliance and dignity in these places.
Yeah, self-reliance, that's the key word right there, you know, because, I think it's way too much that's been built up on various forms of dependency. And really, honestly, it's a bad technology that has resulted in a lot of these things as well, on top of, you know, problematic issues that have arisen. But the fact is that there is a natural functioning way that things operate already. It's not like we don't have to like reinvent the wheel here, you know. But and so it's a method of going back and realizing what actually functions and works and applying that properly. And then, as you say, adopting, you know, self-reliance and responsibility. And I don't think we'd see the world that we have today. You
right.
know?
We're all sort of sitting around waiting for our governments to wake up and start giving us better information and, you know, passing laws that support, you know, better food supply and support, you know, all kinds of things. And I am personally of the belief that we will never see change come from the top down, that it has to occur in a grassroots fashion, because I think that, you know, that those in political power, the interests have been corrupted by the interests of lobbyists, multinational corporate interest. And honestly, you know, I can think of almost no multinational corporation anywhere on planet Earth that wouldn't be heavily invested in every man, woman, and child having a carbohydrate-based diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's highly profitable, it's extremely cheap to produce, and it basically keeps people perpetually hungry. You know, doesn't that work?
And stupid.
And stupid. Yeah, it makes us a lot more malleable, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we're dumber, but we're more malleable. So, you know, there's a nice trade-off. And you know, you can't make a 5,000% profit off of a grass-fed steak like you can, you know, a box of cereal.
Exactly.
And this ends up being of course it's the bottom line. Of course it's the bottom line. Look, I mean, we're talking about who's profiting from our ill health and from the control of big agribusiness over every facet of our lives now, and not to mention just the dominion over our food supply. The number one use of petroleum on the planet is agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, the production and distribution of agricultural foods. So there's the oil industry that has a stake in this. You have, of course, big agribusiness, and we have many names within big agribusiness. Some starting with the letter M, starting others, you know, start with, you know, with other letters. Then we also have the food industry. Virtually every aspect of the food industry, the weight loss industry benefits from all of this. It keeps them in business. Pharmaceutical industry is just raking it in, and you know, undertakers are doing a bang up job raking in profits too.
Yeah, you're right.
From the life that we're living, and so there are literally trillions of dollars at stake. I mean, statin medications alone, and I could rant on this for 2 hours. I won't. I'll spare you, but you know, that's a $29 billion a year business plus. So there's a stake in leading us to believe that dietary cholesterol or cholesterol in any way, shape, or form is somehow at the root of all evil.
Right.
And nothing could be further from the truth.
It's so amazing to me how this is caught on, and this harkens back to what I mentioned earlier about the control of the academic environment, really. And of course, on top of that, it is a media promotional control to a certain extent, even pop culture, yes, even advertisement to a certain extent. But the anti-fat trend, and I mean, again, it's tied to so many things. Not only, of course, the issue of intelligence, of feeding your brain, yes, the right things so you can think straight, but even infertility and things like this that are actually on the rise because of a lack in good fats, you know. And it's
look,
very
our sexual
worrying.
Hormones are steroidal hormones. They are cholesterol based, and we rely healthy fat in order to have healthy hormones. You know.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'll point out that we were literally born as human beings to rely on fat as our primary source of fuel, not sugar, not glucose.
You can even, I saw another guy the other day who was living way up in Alaska, but he talks about you can actually get, and I think you mentioned this last time too, you can actually get way too much protein. You can actually be poisoned by protein, but never by fat. He was eating, I think, straight up, blob from something and even bone marrow and things like that raw.
Yeah,
you know, that's good stuff. We completely outed that from our diet, you know?
Right. Well, there is a protein ceiling. There's only so much that we can healthfully process in our bodies at any given time. Our ancestors may have eaten. This is, again, why the subtitle of my book is Beyond the Paleo Diet, because just because our ancestors ate slabs and slabs of meat, in a sitting, does that necessarily mean that we need to do the same thing? Well, of course not. But it does point out the fact that our bodies are beautifully designed to handle a diet that are based in animal source foods. And that is beyond dispute. There's nothing in the fossil record anywhere to support the idea that we were ever at any time period vegetarians, right back to our earliest supposed ape ancestry.
Right.
You know, all the great apes eat some meat, with the exception of mountain gorillas, and even they eat insects. So, and then there's a scholarly dissertation on this subject written by a man by the name of Craig Stanford, who wrote a book called The Hunting Apes. Or if you want to and have the stomach for it, you can go to YouTube and just type in meat-eating apes, and you'll see some rather graphic footage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not sitting around eating bananas, let's just say. So, and mind you, they do eat, chimps and whatever do eat a disproportionately higher level of plant matter than we are designed to. But here is an interesting little factoid that literally all large mammals are actually designed to gain the majority of their nourishment, majority of their caloric intake from fat. And this includes things like cows and goats and everything else. And including mountain gorillas. And you're thinking, what? These are animals that are eating a carbohydrate-based diet. These are the animals that are actually designed to eat a carbohydrate-based diet. Mm-hmm. In other words, green plant foods. And of course, what are they doing all day? I'm digressing a little bit for a second here. Their faces are in the bushes, they're in the trees, they're in, wherever.
Well, exactly. They have to sit there all day,
Right. In order to be able to extract the nourishment from that in a way that can support their physiological processes.
Yeah.
And that's what they're designed to do. But, gorillas actually obtain a minimum of about 66.4% of their caloric intake from saturated short chain fatty acids. And ruminants get 70 or 80% of their daily caloric intake from saturated fatty acids. And all from the bacterial fermentation of the fiber they are consuming. So they eat the plant material, and it's the bacterial-based digestion that they have in their guts. They have way bigger, large intestines, much smaller small intestines than we do, that are designed, they have a digestive system based in bacterial fermentation. Ours is a hydrochloric acid-based digestion. We are designed to be using hydrochloric acid to break down complete source protein in order to extract the better part of our nourishment. But ruminant animals have more of a bacterial-based digestion.
Interesting. And, that's very interesting, actually, because it's a good point, because a lot of other things occur in the systems on different mammals, and they treat what they eat in a very different way than we would. Very good point.
Right. So, compared to large-bodied apes, we, have this enhanced capacity to digest and metabolize much higher fat diets. And our GI tract, with its greatly expanded small intestine, and we have also pretty substantially reduced colon compared to our, you know, our cousins the apes. It's very, very different from that of chimpanzees or gorillas, and it's consistent with a consumption of what is termed a high quality diet, you know, by anthropologists, with large amounts of animal food. And that's very well established, again, in the literature. This is really not that much seriously debated. But people don't really realize that even the animals that are designed to eat carbohydrates all day long aren't getting their calories from carbohydrates. They're getting their calories from fat, and saturated fat, I might add. So, but we're designed to get that fat more directly from these animals that have done the work for us. If you have an animal that has been eating nothing but fresh green grass its whole life, and then, you know, we eat the meat of that animal, we're getting more omega-3s per gram, or at least as much as we might expect to get from, say, a gram of wild-caught salmon. And of course, these are the very, you know, fatty acids that were in part responsible for the rapid enlargement and the sophistication of the modern day human brain. Well, at least the human brain that we had about 20,000 years ago. So it's extremely interesting. And again, we were literally born to rely on fat as a primary source of fuel. I have a quote from the Journal of Neuroscience Research that states that once the onset of suckling takes place, ketone bodies, ketones, of course, are the energy units of fat, they become the major fuel for brain development. In the textbook of basic neurochemistry, the authors state that, quote, cerebral utilization of ketones is increased more or less in direct proportion to the degree of ketosis. Significant utilization of ketone bodies by the brain is normal in the neonatal period. The newborn infant tends to be hypoglycemic but becomes ketotic when it begins to nurse because of the high fat content of mother's milk. And apart from coconut oil and palm kernel oil, the richest source of medium chain fats, the most ready source of ketones is human breast milk. So that's what we're designed to do. We don't start relying on carbohydrates until we introduce them into our diet. And we're forced to kind of switch over to this, what's supposed to be an auxiliary fuel. If, you know, if that's what's flooding your system all the time, your body will preferentially burn off the rocket fuel before it goes to the stuff that is designed to be more sustainable. And I have this little analogy that I use relating to helping people understand how the way we use carbohydrates so differs from the way we use fats. If we look at carbohydrates and fats strictly from the standpoint of the energy that they provide us with, you can look at carbohydrates sort of metaphorically as being a type of kindling for our metabolic fires. Your brown rice, your beans, your, you know, and other legumes and sweet potatoes and things like that, you can kind of look at as being twigs on our metabolic fire. Mm-hmm. And then white potatoes, white rice, bread, pasta, white potatoes, stuff like that, you can kind of look upon as being crumpled up paper on that metabolic fire. Things like alcohol and sweet beverages are like throwing gasoline or lighter fluid on that metabolic fire. And if all you had to do all day long, if you have, say, you're heating your house with a wood stove, and all you have to heat that wood stove up with is kindling, you could certainly do it. You could heat your house using nothing but kindling. Well, metaphorically, 98% of people in our modern society are doing that all the time.
Need to throw a log on there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, what you're basically going to be doing is you're going to be pulled up in front of that wood stove, and you're going to be grabbing handfuls of twigs and crumpled up paper and lighter fluid, whatever, all day long in order to keep that fire going.
Yeah.
And you know, say you try to go to sleep through the night, and there's an analogy to be made here, metaphor, that, you know, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and the house is freezing cold, and you go and you look, oh my God, the fire's going out, and you're throwing crumpled up paper in there and whatever. But if instead you take a nice big fat log and you throw that on the fire, now you're basically free. You're not having to be preoccupied constantly with where that next handful of fuel is coming from. You can go off and live your life. You can even sleep through the night. Yeah. And you wake up the next morning and the fire's burning down. You say, oh, fire's burning down, I'll throw another log on the fire. And you go about your business. and you don't have the same preoccupation, the same cravings. But again, we all have to kind of question, who is it that's benefiting from a world that is eating in a way that preoccupies us with where
exactly.
the next handful of
exactly.
fuel is coming from?
Because, I mean, let's face it, this is due to the fact that we're not meant to be grazers, I believe. Why have we developed things as, you know, astronomy and philosophers, and we've had time to other aspects of focus in life, and that's maybe, I mean, again, why do we have that large brain that we do, right? But
right.
Now it's like we've gone backwards, and due to the food choices we have, we're back in that, you know, problematic issue of lower IQ, and the fact that we're on a falling curve there, you know, in that regard.
Right.
So it's very it makes sense.
I
it makes
find
sense.
That this ties into so many things that impact our lives, and to me, this is core and central, and something we actually have, you know, some control over. Look, again, like I said, fat makes up roughly 80% of our brain and nervous system by its dry weight. And again, it's made up of the fats that we supply it with what we choose to eat. But the normal composition of the human brain is roughly half of it is saturated fat, evil saturated fat.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right.
About another 11% of the composition of the fats in the human brain are made up of arachidonic acid, you know, evil arachidonic acid, right? Another animal source of fat. About a fourth of all the fatty acids making up your brain are docosahexaenoic acid, that elongated form of omega-3s that are found almost exclusively in animal source foods. I say almost because there are some forms of algae they can extract it from using questionable means, I might add. But I don't know anybody with an algae deficiency. So,
right.
But only a fourth of your body's entire repository of cholesterol exists in your brain. And it gosh darn well better be there, because it's essential for optimal cognitive functioning. One of the common side effects, and I'm here to tell you very common side effects of statin use or of, you know, cholesterol-lowering medication use, are dementia-like symptoms. I run into this all the time. It's like, oh gosh, I don't know, my memory's been so bad lately. It's like, are you on a statin by any chance? But this is established in the literature as well. So they've also discovered, certainly according to one of the most respected ketone researchers, his name's Dr. Richard Veach. You can go look up his research papers. There are many of them. Ketone bodies from dietary fats in ketogenic diets, which is largely what I end up promoting in my book, Primal Body, Primal Mind. It boils down to that. May not only treat, but also prevent Alzheimer's disease. They're an abundant, stable, steady source of fuel, even in the absence of regular meals, you know, assuming that you're in a healthy, well-adapted ketogenic state. You don't have to replenish it all the time. Even the slenderest person listening to this podcast, you know, could go up to, you know, a month or more without, theoretically at least, without eating, has enough fat on their bodies to supply energy for a good month or so. I'm not saying you'd like it or that you should do it that way, but we can't store much more than a couple thousand calories or kilocalories of carbohydrates at any given time, mostly in the form of glycogen in both our liver and in our muscles. You know, it's something that we tend to burn off very rapidly. The human body is obsessed with maintaining the lowest level of blood sugar at any given time. So we tend to burn it preferentially to fats when carbohydrates are present, and we're more likely to store fat in the presence of carbohydrate. And also because carbohydrate tends to stimulate insulin, which it's impossible to burn fat the same time you're producing insulin. That's physiologically impossible. So, you know, a ketogenic state even can improve your cerebral blood flow by about 39% in normal people. And it can also reduce cognitive dysfunction associated with things like systemic hypoglycemia. You know, in other words, symptoms of low blood sugar. So, you know, human brain growth is entirely dependent on dietary fats, and especially these 20 and 22 carbon fatty acids like DHA, you know, docosahexaenoic acid and arachidonic acid. In other words, dietary animal source fats. We allocate a way larger share of our energy budget to our brains than do other primates or other mammals. So if, you know, you're talking about getting energy from something like starchy roots and tubers, you know, during our earlier evolution, Those would have, for starters, required really extensive cooking. In their raw form, starch in roots and tubers isn't absorbed at all. It's just not utilizable to us, and it passes through as non-digestible carbohydrate. But when we heat it, then the starch kind of swells up, and it gets disrupted from the cell walls, and it's a process called gelatinization, and it makes starch more accessible to break down by digestive enzymes. But the evidence seems to also suggest that ancient Europeans 40,000 years ago were really ill-equipped. There were certain amylase enzymes that we've only since kind of developed that really weren't available to some ancient European ancestors of ours. In other words, even if they were eating starch, they may not have been able to make use of it, even if it was cooked very, very well. Yeah. But even so, even if they were happily gobbling up potatoes all day long and they had the fire to do it and the amylase mechanism with which to do it, the energy values of those foods are way less than animal source foods, even after cooking.
Yeah.
And fruits are something that would have only been seasonally or climatically available to us. So we have, again, this enhanced capacity to digest and metabolize much higher fat diets. And without this metabolic adaptation, we never would have evolved such a large brain.
Exactly. Yeah, that's just it. And I wonder how many issues that arise, today that actually results in stress. Because, I mean, let's face it, a lot of it has to do with problem solving, issues that arise that we feel overwhelmed with. If we don't have the capacity of using our brain to the full extent, we are going to go increasingly into a downward spiral, right?
Right. Right. We become much more malleable. We become, the dumber we become, to put it bluntly, the easier it is to control us. People are way more concerned with, I can't generalize, especially with this audience, because your audience members are a lot savvier than we're talking about the average humans. But a lot of people are way more concerned with just Justin Bieber's newest haircut than they are.
Sure.
What kind of things are really happening on a global, political scale or an environmental scale. There just isn't that preoccupation. I was actually on the Dr. Oz show this last year. And before being interviewed, I was working with the producers, who were terrific people. It was a very interesting experience, to say the least, because I got to learn how the mega mass media views the general public.
Oh yeah, this is always fascinating.
It is.
Yeah.
And this is what I am literally quoting. The mega mass media is basically, on average, is basically 4 years old. And nothing gets, not fourth grade, not 12 years old, not sixth grade or whatever, 4 years old. So anything that would not be understandable to a four-year-old doesn't get included in the program.
Yeah.
Everything has to be in simple terms. And you can't, of course, I wasn't allowed to say things that might offend, advertisers and things like that. I had to, my words were very carefully orchestrated. I had about a 2-hour discussion with one of the producers. And then the next, day or two later was emailed a script that I was supposed to follow and not deviate from during the course of the show. And I'm looking at this thinking, I'm not an actress. I don't, use scripts and I don't memorize scripts. And furthermore, she took what she thought I had said and kind of dumbed it down.
Oh boy.
And I looked at that and I thought, well, that's not right. And so I had to kind of retool it at least. But it was crazy how short a leash people are on when you are dealing with the mega mass media, and nobody gets more than 10 minutes.
No, of course, never. Never explain anything. How incredibly contrived and controlled it must be. And I think it's not only criminal to do it in this way, but the very fact that it's a sad that they look down on their own audience and say, these people are really stupid, so let's dumb it down. But the very basic idea that they're not even trying to have their audience come up to a certain, well, let's raise the bar then. What's wrong with that? Have them step up to the plate and try to understand this bit. But no, not, I mean, that's the complicity in the picture. They want to keep them dumb. That's the point, you know?
There was something that I resisted greatly when I wrote Primal Body, Primal Mind. I was encouraged by some people to really dumb it down, and I refused to do that. Now, I use a lot of useful analogy, and I've almost never had somebody come up to me and say, it was so over my head, I just couldn't, because it's written in small bite-sized pieces. But to me, I really want people to get this. I don't just want to tell them what to do. I want them to understand why they need to do it and to be able to supply the scientific evidence to support that so that they know why they're doing it and they can remember why they're doing it. You know, I have all too often people come up and just say, you know, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. I don't need to understand all the details. Right. I just want, just hand me a menu and, yeah, you know, whatever. And I refuse to do that because that's a very short-term solution. People will start doing things. They might even feel better for a while, but sooner or later, the old habits come back to haunt them. Exactly. They forget why they were doing it in the first place. They go to a birthday party and what will that one piece of cake hurt? And next thing you know, they're back off and running again with their old habits, and they just sort of have the attitude that, well, that way of eating didn't work for me. You know, for me, it's really important. I'm passionate about seeing other people self-empowered. I'm not interested in controlling anybody's. I'm not even interested in convincing people who aren't interested in being convinced. This is information for people that are kind of ready to hear it and want to understand the reasons why and kind of want to know how to go about it and all of that. It's about self-empowerment. It's the only way we have of getting out of the mess we are in right now in the mm-hmm. world.
Yeah. Very good point. That's what it's about, really, in having people having a foundational understanding of why they do certain things. Why am I applying this? And how does it, because I mean, all of that springboards to other things later on where you can, there's a reasoning behind it because new things are going to come along. You haven't told everybody about every little thing you can or can't eat, but it's like, I've noticed that it's even on a basis that people don't even analyze what is in the food. They don't even look at the ingredients or they don't even comprehend, okay, is that a chemical or is this actually a natural food? What's going on here? And that's, so it's a lot of issues to work on here, but frankly, people have to, you know, develop an interest in these things and raise the bar of how they want to live their lives. Otherwise, what's the point, right? You know?
Look, yeah, well, you know, we need to take an interest in this machine in which, actually, I don't think of the human body as a machine, but for sake of argument, you know, this thing that we inhabit, this physical body that we inhabit, instead of just entrusting its care to somebody else who claims to know how it works and what it needs to do, whose best interest may not be with your best interest, but instead may lie with profit. You know, we're living in these bodies. You know, why is it such a stretch for us to take the time to understand better how the body was designed and how it actually works, what it best runs on, you know? And I, you know, again, I make a case for that, and I offer some basic steps that people can take to understanding these things better so that, you know, it's a little bit like if you're listening to an LP, some of us remember these, you know, vinyl records. You know, and you've listened to it over and over again a number of times. If you drag a needle across it or take a nail or whatever and scratch through it, it's not going to quite play the same way the next time around. And Primal Body, Primal Mind really takes and gets you to think about everything you've been told about what does and doesn't constitute a healthy diet and how your body's actually designed to function in a whole different way. And it just, it's designed to sort of tickle your thinking, open up your thinking to a different way of looking at this and maybe challenging you to dig a little deeper. Don't take my word for it. Dig a little deeper. You know, I don't have the last word on this, and science isn't the last word. It's the latest word, right?
Right.
So, yeah. You know,
if it's correct. Yeah.
But you know, I'm not just an armchair researcher. I have been in private clinical practice for the last 20 years, working extremely full time with people in a couple of different capacities, working with people's brains and nervous systems, and also doing you know, nutritional consultation and nutritional therapy. I've had the opportunity to deal with a huge variety of human suffering, and I've also had the ability to see what works and what doesn't, to hear people's own experiences of things that they have tried and what has worked and what hasn't for them, in addition to understanding what kinds of tests that need to be done in order to sort of get a clearer picture of what's actually going on with you, and then understanding how to prioritize that as a way of being able to kind of restore a healthier state of functioning. There's a tremendous amount that we can do. There's so much information available out there. And the beautiful thing is that there's so much that can be done using using natural means and using more natural approaches to diet and nutrition and all kinds of different nutritional application to radically improve the way we feel and function. And by the way, last I looked, most people's brains were screwed onto their bodies. There's no such thing as a mind-body connection. It's all part of the same sort of functioning or dysfunctioning system, and it just has to be understood together in context. People don't realize that how they feel emotionally may be directly correlated to what it is that they're eating or maybe not eating.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you talked a lot about the endocrine system before. We know about all the endocrine disruptors, and I mean, just hormones overall, it's a huge, you know, part of this equation. And there are things people can do in terms of screenings and checking, you know, a panel on their hormones and everything, and to get an idea of where they might be lacking and what they can do in a natural way to kind of rebalance some of their hormones to get, I mean, this affects your emotions, your, you know, your sex drive, fertility, you know, a lot of these things.
Everything. And, you know, our two big master hormones are leptin and insulin. And everything is sort of an outgrowth of that. Those regulate what go on with the rest of the endocrine system. And then, of course, you know, we have our adrenal hormones associated with survival and everything else. But, you know, leptin is a fat sensor. And again, fat is central to survival for us as a species. It has that nutrient density that is critical for us. And if hunting is good and there is sufficient fat present, you know, the leptin will tend to relax our cravings our tendency to overeat. It relaxes those temptations or those cravings for foods that aren't necessarily that good for us. Insulin and leptin are birds of a feather. Insulin isn't necessarily a blood sugar hormone, but it does seem to be most triggered in terms of its release by carbohydrate-based foods, because every molecule of carbohydrate that we consume over what we need for immediate energy, you know, is basically considered excess. And insulin is about taking excess nutrients and moving them into storage for later use in case of a famine or something. It will also take excess protein, you know, and store that as well and convert a significant amount of that to sugar, and we'll store it in a similar fashion or use it the same way. And it turns out that insulin is the limiting factor when it comes to it's actually central to the issue of longevity. That you know, for 75 years or more, longevity researchers discovered there was something called caloric restriction, which was popularized for a while. That if you reduce the amount of calories that you took in substantially or significantly, that it seemed to have the almost counterintuitive effect of extending healthy lifespan. But they never really knew why that was. And again, it seemed like a counterintuitive concept, but they just figured it was a caloric thing, that it was just too many calories in general. Mm-hmm. So they would restrict calories across the board and things would live longer. But it was Cynthia Kenyon in the last decade that figured out what was actually going on with that. She was doing some research at UCSF and ended up figuring out that it was actually insulin. There was interesting because she was doing work with this microscopic worm called C. elegans or planaria, basically. And there was a mutation that occurred in this research study that doubled the life of the planaria. And of course, everybody's eyes bugged out and they thought, what the hell was that? Because, you know, this was the hugest leap in lifespan of anything we've ever studied what the heck did that?
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up isolating the gene that seemed to be responsible, the mutation. Usually mutations are not a good thing for us. They inconvenience us or cause us to die quicker. Yep. This one doubled the lifespan, so they were super interested. And they isolated the gene. They called it the DAF2 gene, but they didn't know what it did for another couple of years. And then they figured it out. It encoded an insulin receptor. And it turds out that the more less insulin that we end up needing in the course of our lifetimes, the longer we live and the healthier we are by far. And so insulin is one of the mitigating factors. And this is all based on how cells reproduce. And this goes back to the earliest primordial seas, where the first, you know, prokaryotic organisms emerged in these oxygen-free and, you know, with the zero oxygen atmosphere we used to have, or the low oxygen atmosphere.
Anaerobic bacteria and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yes. That the two things that were available for fuel early on when life was forming on planet Earth were sugars and proteins. And it turns out that there's a metabolic pathway that also triggers something similar that's related to the insulin pathway, and it's called mTOR, mammalian target of rapamycin. It's our inherent protein sensor. When we consume protein in excess of what we need to make for our maintenance and our repair, it upregulates cellular proliferation. Now, if we're reproducing, obviously that's a good thing. Or if we're growing, say a newborn baby, and we need to make new cells, obviously, we need those mechanisms intact. So I don't recommend restricting protein intake in infants, children, teens, pregnant women, things like that. Mm-hmm. But once we're done growing, we kind of maxed out in terms of the number of cells we need to grow. If you're upregulating those pathways are also responsible. If you've been exposed to, you know, environmental toxins and things that are mutating your DNA in some way, and then those damaged cells start to proliferate, that's basically what's called cancer. That is a mechanism for the proliferation of cancer. But if, on the other hand, you minimize the need for insulin, you minimize the need for mTOR, you're dialing down those proliferative pathways, what ends up getting upregulated instead is our maintenance and repair. To put it in modern day economic terms that I'm sure our friend Catherine Austin Fitz would like, you know, it's like saying it's too expensive right now to build a new house, so instead let's fix up the one that we've got.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And yep. And that's literally anti-aging. And that's the loophole that I talk about in Primal Body, Primal Mind, that basically takes those basic principles. We need complete source protein from animal source foods. We don't actually need carbohydrate. There's nothing in any medical textbook of physiology anywhere on planet Earth that states that carbohydrates are essential to us all dietarily. There just isn't. They're not. And because glucose is so inherently damaging and sugars are so inherently damaging to us, they glycate tissues. Glycation is a process by which sugars will combine with proteins and fats and cause them to become sticky and misshapen and start to malfunction. They stimulate more insulin production, which again, we know has an aging and disease promoting effect upon us. And sugars also, you know, there was a recent, there were a couple of recent studies actually that showed that even moderate increases in blood sugar made us more susceptible to dementia. You didn't even have to be diabetic to be more susceptible to dementia as a result of even moderately elevated blood sugar. Because it isn't essential to us, because it attracts free radical activity, because it is so inherently damaging to our system, to me, it's kind of a no-brainer to leave it out of the diet as much as possible.
Of course, yeah.
And instead, focus on moderating your protein intake, which also makes it a much more sustainable diet on a larger scale for people. You know, we're not having to eat slabs and slabs and slabs of meat, so there's more protein to go around if we're doing this right. Eating as many fibrous vegetables and greens as you want as a way of getting extra antioxidants, extra phytonutrients, and detoxification potential.
Do you believe in that, kind of balancing the alkaline acidity level with aid of the vegetables as well, supplementing the meat and all that? Or are you concerned? I don't know if you're concerned with that or not.
Well, I think what they're really talking about when they talk about pH like that is they're talking about taking pressure off the buffering system in the body, right? Really, our blood pH isn't really impacted. I mean, again, if you're talking about acidity versus alkalinity, what part of the body are you talking about? Because the pH of the saliva is very different from the pH of, say, the stomach, or the pH of the small intestine, or the pH of the large intestine, or of your skin. Now, if you're talking about the bloodstream, which is what I think people are referring to when they talk about overall pH, yes, our bloodstream needs to be slightly alkaline, but that is actually regulated by a relationship between CO2 and bicarbonate through breathing. I mean, breathing basically is what controls our blood pH. Now, mind you, if our pH starts to drop because maybe there's more acidity or whatever in our system, or because, you know, whatever is happening that's acidifying to the bloodstream, your body's going to have to draw from more buffering agents like your bone and whatever else in order to counter that. And I think that's really what they're talking about.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, but again, sugars are extremely acidifying.
Exactly. You know, yeah. Of course they are. Yeah.
Big time.
It's one of the worst.
And so, you know, all of this stuff kind of has, yes, eat as many fibrous vegetables and greens as you want. You know, you can squeeze lemon in water if you're really into the alkalizing effect. I don't overly preoccupy myself with the pH thing. I get the arguments around that, but, you know, my focus is more on meeting foundational nutritional requirements and maximizing healthy lifespan based on what, you know, seems to be emerging from the literature on longevity research. And it's pretty clear that the mitigating factors are sugars and protein. Now, we do have a fundamental requirement for dietary protein, and we do have a requirement for complete protein. We can't, you know, we have to have all the complete protein in sufficient quantity, because complete protein is not necessarily sufficient protein. And if you're combining beans and rice to get your complete protein, you're also supplying a ton of starch to that. So, yeah. You know, we're trying to maximize nutrient density here. And in doing so, it ends up being actually, even though you're getting a higher percentage of your calories from dietary fat, fat's very satiating from natural, healthy, unadulterated sources of dietary fat. Because fat's so inherently satiating, you're satisfied with less food. You're also getting a lot more fat-soluble nutrients, which we know are the superstars today. They're making all the headlines: vitamin D, vitamin A, vitamin K2, but, you know, vitamin E, things like that, that are really, really essential to the way our genes are expressed. For instance, those are the things that modify our gene expression, are fat-soluble nutrients. You know, they use intracellular signaling pathways that initiate or modify our gene expression, and they have a direct effect on gene transcription. So they're uniquely powerful in terms of how, you know, getting back to the original topic of epigenetics, fat-soluble nutrients have everything to do with how we express, how our genes are expressed in this lifetime. We want to have sufficient fat-soluble nutrients to have appropriate signaling, but you can't absorb fat-soluble nutrients without also having significant dietary fat to go with that.
Mm, yeah, interesting.
You know?
So, I think we've ended up in a situation where we're trying with all these various things to balance an already very unstable behavior to begin with. So we're supplementing and looking over here and doing this over there, and everything is like kind of, we're playing catch up, and we're not really going to the source root of the matter, you know, because right. our whole way of associating with the food these days is like we're doing it wrong, and that's why we're getting all these issues, right? So
absolutely, you know. And by the way, the number one thing that that cancer needs in order to survive is sugar, right?
Yep.
And interestingly, though, if you're eating a fat-based ketogenic diet and you're relying on ketones as your primary source of fuel, the way we were designed, I might add, and it's so much more logical. I mean, fat is just it's something that is a stable, lasting source of fuel and doesn't have to be replenished all of the time. Doesn't it make sense that that's what our body and brain would want to rely on instead of something so volatile and unreliable as blood sugar, which is all over the place? You know, if we went for more than a few days without eating, I mean, the way things are today, the majority of people with sugar-based metabolisms aren't more than two meals away from a total state of metabolic, you know, chaos.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Two missed meals away. But going back to the cancer issue, you know, the World Health Organization has stated that cancer rates are expected to climb more than 70% in the next 20 years. I think that number's probably low. But there was a really wonderful study in the British Journal of Cancer, and it kind of encapsulates a lot of what I'm talking about. And what the researchers in this article said, and kind of bear with me because it gets really, really interesting. They said if the anti-tumor effects of restricted caloric intake are associated with reduced glucose levels and glycolytic energy is where you're getting your energy from sugar, a question arises as to what role elevated ketone levels might have in CT2A management, which is basically inflammatory management. We suggest that ketone body metabolism, while providing normal brain cells with an alternative high-energy substrate, also reduces the inflammatory activities of tumor-associated host cells, that ketone body metabolism reduces oxygen-free radicals, it enhances tolerance to hypoxia, and may prevent organ dysfunction from inflammatory processes. Hence, a shift in energy metabolism from glucose to ketones will enhance the bioenergetic potential of normal brain cells on the one hand, while reducing tumor cell growth and tumor inflammatory properties on the other hand. And my attitude is, why wait?
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We all don't have cancer until the day we do. I was talking with Dr. Joseph Mercola, who you may be familiar with.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, and we both agreed that we should all be basically eating every day as if we had cancer.
Because exactly, yeah.
Right? Otherwise, you have no way of knowing. So you want to be detoxifying. So yeah, you know, have those vegetables, eat those salads, and get that organic produce in your body, and buy it from your local farmers as much as possible.
Yeah,
you know, get in touch with where your food is actually coming from. That's another huge piece of what we're missing today in our modern world. We've become so separate from our natural environment. I mean, I think that's one reason. I mean, to me, in some respects, veganism represents a total disconnect.
It does, yeah.
Our natural relationship to our environment that we evolved in. Our primitive, so-called primitive ancestors, had a deeper reverence for life than anything that we could possibly comprehend. And interestingly, they didn't see the animals they hunted as being separate from them. They saw the animals they hunted as being an extension of who they were. In direct contrast of the way we see the world, everything is in our society is predicated on us being separated from everything else. And we are not encouraged to think of any kind of, in any kind of non-dual terms. because, you know, God forbid we should see ourselves as one with the people we're supposed to be arming ourselves against as enemies. That, you know, primitive cultures saw the animals that they hunted and the natural world around them as being an extension of who they were. And when they ate the meat of that animal, it wasn't just throwing something in their gut because they were hungry or had a craving. It was sacrament. You know, these animals were sacred to these people groups. And yet that sacredness didn't make them into vegetarians. There is a cycle of life of which we are a part, whether we like it or not.
Exactly. And that's just it. That's why I see a lot of this as it's a war on human nature and mother nature, really, that a lot of people are refusing to accept where they find themselves, you know, and they're trying to fight that on every conceivable level. And I think it does us great harm, you know, to do that.
Right. Everything that lives or breathes in this world must at some time serve as food for something else. You know, all of us have to kill in order to eat, even a vegan. Of course, it's taking the life of a plant, you know, and I'm sure that a spinach plant would argue eloquently for its life if it had the voice with which to do so.
Yeah.
You know, but that said, all living things in this world are designed by nature to eat a certain way and ultimately serve as food for something else. That's just the nature of the game. It's not bad or good. It just is.
Yeah.
And this is all part of this natural cycle of life and death. Neither you or I or anybody listening to this is above that. And I doubt, you know, any vegan would render the same judgment against, say, wolves or lions simply because they're designed to eat meat and hunting is part of their evolution.
They'll get to that. They'll start feeding them tofu, you know.
Yeah, some are, yeah. Actually, yeah. Ideas in some of the more radical parts of the community to, like, build this big fence on the African savanna that separates the predators from the somehow.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, you're going to see all kinds, but most people are rational enough to say, well, yeah, you know, it's lions are designed. I mean, meat eating has been part of our fossil record from the very, very, very beginning, more than 3 million years ago. You know, it was a paper published just last year that just discovered that we actually had a consistent hunting economy just over 2 million years ago. So, In other words, animal source foods were at the center, were foundational to our diet by that time. We have a brain and a physiological makeup that's exceedingly well adapted to animal source foods as an essential and primary source of nourishment. And among anthropologists and paleoanthropologists, there's just simply no question about this. This is not a good versus evil issue. It's just simply, you know, the way the natural world is that we live in. And I see vegetarianism and veganism, although I'm sympathetic to their concerns about the planet, believe me, I share it. I used to go door to door for Greenpeace. I've worked in a veterinary capacity. I care deeply about suffering, whether it's the suffering of humans or suffering of animals. And I've battled these battles in my life. But to me, you know, I also recognize that there's a cycle of life of which I'm a part, and we can't be judgmental about that. We can't be sacrificial lambs to these saintly ideals of, you know, don't kill or harm anything. There is no such thing.
It's a suicidal altruistic behavior, really, and where you're
right,
you're setting yourself outside of that somehow you're not even worth to be part of that cycle of life, right? Because you're doing exactly everything you can to kind of stop the suffering in the world. I mean, I think it's a mental issue, really, that people need to overcome, you know.
Well, and it's also being promoted by various government agencies and by ex-presidents and, you know, sort of being subtly promoted now.
Popular, very popular now.
Whole Foods, I don't know if you know about Whole Foods Market. It's a big chain.
Oh, sure, yeah.
You know,
I've been there, yeah.
And they've taken now the official stand of only wanting to promote vegetarian diets. You know, that's the only healthy way people, you know, of course, they're still selling meat. I mean, they're basically, you know, working against a significant the majority actually of their clientele, but they're saying, well, this is the way what we want to promote. Well, what might be behind that? Who stands to profit if everybody is eating a plant-based diet? Do you think that this is all symptomatic of a human culture that's lost all of its connection to the natural world from which it came?
Yes.
You know, there's nothing unspiritual about eating meat. Even the Dalai Lama, you know, with his known Buddhist reverence for life, eats meat. Jesus ate meat, you know. He understands that he is not above this cycle of life. There's no moral superiority, you know, with a plant-based diet. There's no greater destruction that has ever been wrought upon the earth and all life upon it than through agriculture. I mean,
you're right.
And I doubt there's a single mega multinational corporation, as I've said, that wouldn't be heavily invested in us all being eating plant-based foods, you know, including the chemical industries supplying all the herbicides and pesticides and the mining industries raping phosphorus for fertilizer from the earth, you know, all that stuff.
To clarify there, you're also talking about the very cattle and everything else that were raised are not supposed to, you know, have that food either. They're supposed to have wild, natural grazing, you know? Yeah.
Right. It makes them sick, but who cares if a domestic animal's sick, if all it's being, you know, it's just, you know, we raise domestic animals are designed to be utilitarian. They're not, you know, we don't raise them to optimize their health for longevity or whatever.
Which is bizarre because ultimately we know and understand that that's passed down to us. So again, it's a loathing and hatred against oneself, you know, really.
Right. We're told by official sources that what an animal eats doesn't make any difference to us.
Do they really say that?
The majority of people don't get that the quality of the meat that we eat, for instance, directly correlates to the health that of the animal that meat came from.
Wow. That's amazing. That's amazing to have that stance, actually. Wow.
Yeah. Most people don't get that is an issue.
Yeah.
It's kind of a surprise to them. I mean, it makes immediate sense once they start to think of it that way, but we're conditioned not to think of it that way. But, you know, you can also think, you know, but the agricultural lands are, you know, in order to plant an agricultural plot, you have to sterilize that plot of every living thing on it, every living organism, every whatever, except for the crops that are grown on it. You know, and just even putting a plow to the soil leads to the degradation and erosion of the soil. People don't think about also the massive amount of resources that are used for mainstream big agriculture. You know, the amount of water that is thrown on these crops, and most of which are genetically modified now.
Yeah.
You know, all of that. So, you know,
they scrape the earth. You know, even the unnatural way that they turn the earth over, and this dries out, and all the topsoil blows away. You know, and it's like that's why you have to continue to put more, you know, phosphorus and, you know, everything else they put on there. Right. But there's so many more minerals that we need. I mean, again, nothing is natural about it.
Right. You put nitrogen, phosphorus, and, you know, potassium in the soil. It makes the things that you grow on it look leafy green and all. But the nutrient content of even organically grown produce today is a minute fraction of what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need that much more nutrient density to try to compensate, you know, for everything that we're missing. I do think that there's a role for supplements to play. I'm, by the way, not a supplement huckster. I have some Amazon affiliate links to certain products that people have asked me over and over again, what do you recommend for this or that? So it's like, okay, well, mm-hmm. you know, so there's certain brand names of certain supplements that I think are useful for certain things. And I put links on my website to make that convenient for people. I maybe make 2 cents off a sale of those things. I don't sell. I don't have a supplement line. I'm not a huckster that way. But I do think that there's a role that they have to play. And I think you also have to be extremely judicious about what you're selecting. And I tend to, when I'm working with a client, I do a lot of testing to figure out what kinds of things are going to be best needed for support, and then prioritize that as a way of not overwhelming people with a bunch of pills.
Right.
But there's a lot you can do with superfoods. And again, you know, again, our ancestors also did a lot of nose-to-tail eating, and some of the most nutritious parts of animals are actually the organ meats.
Well, exactly. Very good point. Again, some of it, we know that they ate raw as well, which is another issue here. But nonetheless, just the idea that we're cutting up the finest little filet, and that's it. You know, when they used to eat the bone marrow and eyes, and some even ate the brain and everything. And it's like,
yes,
this is completely out of the picture today, which is another huge, you know, detrimental process to it. But I understand to a certain extent, it's not easy to eat the eyeballs of something, or, you know, the brain and stuff like that. It could be quite gruesome. But is there any,
right,
have you tried any of this? Is there any way to make it seem less, you know, conspicuous
gross
in that way?
you know, for instance, a lot of people in the paleo community who don't like the taste of liver, for instance, although, you know, pâté, for instance, can be a very tasty way to get it. You know, there are different pâtés, poultry pâtés, you know, goose liver, duck liver, whatever, chicken liver pâté. But you can also take, for instance, a liver, and you can grind it up inside grass-fed ground beef in a way that you're just not going to taste it. And, you know, that's a really easy way to do that. Things like sweetbreads are a really great way, which are effectively the thymus gland of young animals, and not necessarily young animals, but probably the better sweetbreads would be, and are enormously nutritious. You know, really great for your immune system, and actually, if you know when you prepare them, they actually mostly taste like chicken. I mean, they really have a very mild flavor. That's one of the easier ones to incorporate. You know, anything that you don't necessarily love the taste of, you can grind up into something else and make a little bit inconspicuous. But it is a really good idea to try to be a little venturesome, be a little adventurous, try some different recipes for things, to see what you can do to make these things, more palatable. Although I think you'd be surprised at how palatable a lot of organ meats really can be.
Yeah, and I mean, we have to come on, toughen up a bit too here. As you said earlier, you know, everything has become about the taste and the texture, and that's it. I mean, not
right.
All of it is just for the pleasure of your mouth,
right,
and that's it. I mean, let your food be your medicine, and your medicine be your food, right? So,
right, Well, and you know, for instance, what we think of as meat, which is sort of like steak cuts and things like that, really would have been considered the least nutritious part of the animal. Really, what was coveted were the organ meets, you know, and by the way, those are the cheapest part of the animal too. The most nutritious parts are also the cheapest parts.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's interesting that people say, well, this just isn't economically feasible. This is too expensive. Who could possibly afford to eat this way? I have a friend who is like the world's most conscientious person when it comes to how much things cost. She knows to the last penny what everything costs her every month. She keeps track of all of that. She actually told me when she came to visit, and she was saying, and by the way, she used to be vegetarian and she's not anymore. But she actually found that this was actually the least expensive way to eat that has made her feel better than anything has ever made her feel that is out there. She was just kind of gushing about how affordable this was for her. And after we talked about it for a while, I kind of got down on bended knee. I found myself sinking onto one knee and said, will you please write a book and will you please call it Primal Tightwad? Which she did.
Oh, really? That's funny.
She calculates down to the last penny what it costs her to eat every month. And one of the things that she did, and nothing ticks me off more, by the way, than the myth that in order to eat really healthfully well, that you have to be wealthy somehow.
Right,
That's a myth.
exactly.
Myth. So she took a week's worth of menu from the standard American or standard Western, I guess, you know, for the sake of a broader audience, diet. It's all pretty much the same. And she calculated down to the last penny what it cost to eat that way. 1 tablespoon of ketchup, 2 cents, you know, or whatever. All the way down to the last thing, and included some soft drinks and maybe one or two trips to McDonald's and your hamburger helpers and, you know, whatever else. And calculated at the end of the week, tallied that up and came up with a number for the cost. And then she went and she calculated a week's worth of menus for the diet that I'm talking about. And we're talking totally organic, 100% grass-fed, you know, way of eating, right? And calculated all that out, what it cost for one person to eat that way for an entire week, came up with that total. At the end of that those 2 weeks, it was actually cheaper to eat the way that I'm talking about. And not only that, it literally worked out to being $1,500 per person per year cheaper.
How about
So
that?
nobody's going to tell me. And you know, when you think about it, as soon as you start leaving out all the processed garbage, all the sodas and drinks and pasteurized milk and beverages and you know the crap that people buy, you know, beer and whatever that they spend their money on every week. Think of what you're saving by not buying that. None of this
Exactly.
is taking into account eventual healthcare
Well,
costs.
exactly. I was going to say that, not even to begin to talk about the potential medical, expenses that could be on top of this. So that's interesting. Was there anything that, you can actually, when you eat this way, you can actually eat a little bit less, so that helped to balance it? Or was it about the same, amount, at the end of the
Well,
day?
we weren't calculating, or she wasn't calculating the energy, like the calories gotten from this thing and all of the nutritional value. Although clearly, when you're eating a more nutrient-dense diet, you have less of a need to overeat. And so ultimately, it ends up being kind of a calorically pretty moderate diet. You're not getting as many calories as you think you would be by eating a higher percentage of your calories from fat. I probably get about 70% of my calories from dietary fat. I find that I'm actually very satisfied with not very much food. I can take a big, you know, maybe for lunch, a great big salad with the whole variety of chopped vegetables in it and, you know, throw a bunch of avocado in there. And a little bit, maybe 2 or 3 ounces of sliced meat per meal is all that anybody needs, unless you're an Olympic athlete, you know, and that even then you wouldn't need that much more. And then, you season that, add a bunch of olive oil. You can cook the meat in some coconut oil or whatever if you want, or something like duck fat or butter if you tolerate dairy, which I don't. A little balsamic or cider vinegar or whatever you like, and you have an absolutely delicious meal. And you know, with enough fat on there, you're not hungry afterwards. You can go a very long time. I can eat a single, duck egg cooked, at 6 o'clock in the morning, and or tiny little, you know, 2 or 3 ounce sausage patty, you know, full fat sausage patty, first thing in the morning. And if I haven't eaten by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I might be hungry, but I'm not. I don't
not going to collapse.
Experience blood sugar symptoms because I basically removed myself metabolically from that whole, you know, from the whole mood, cognitive, and energetic equation that's associated with blood sugar stability.
Yeah.
You know, when you're relying on fat. So here's how your listeners can figure out if they have a problem with blood sugar or not. The question, the first question to ask yourself is, how do you feel if you have gone for a long time, say, you know, several hours without eating? Are you feeling more fatigued? Are you feeling more brain fogged, more irritable, maybe a little something that rhymes with itchy? Are you feel any agitation at all? You're more likely to snap at people or whatever. But conversely, after you eat, how do you feel? Do you feel better in some way? Do you feel like, okay, now I've got a new lease on life. I'm energized again. I can, you know, go back at it. Or do you maybe feel a little drowsier? If you've answered yes to anything I've just said, you have a problem. So the next question, of course, comes, well, how are you supposed to feel when you haven't eaten for a number of hours? Well, the answer to that question is hungry. And the answer to the question of how are you supposed to feel after you've eaten a meal, the answer to that question is not hungry. Mm. That is all.
Yep.
That's what is normal. And if it's anything else, you aren't dealing well. You have an issue with blood sugar. It's not being managed well, and you're a slave to that metabolic fire. And you know, you can, I guess, spend your day grabbing handfuls of twigs and crumpled up paper and squirting the occasional lighter fluid on it to keep that fire going. That's what the majority of our society does, and it effectively enslaves you to that wood stove and to who knows what else. I personally prefer not to be a slave to my metabolic wood stove or anything else. And so to me, one of the most freeing things I've ever done is switch my metabolism from one based in carbohydrate dependence to one based in a primary dependence on fat as my major source of fuel and ketones.
Yeah.
And it's been one of the most liberating things I've ever done.
Well, very good, very good. This has been, you know, great. A lot of good material here to digest and to think about and of course contemplate. And there's a lot more, of course, in the books we haven't talked about. And as a last measure, why don't we talk a little bit more about that and see what where people can go pick up copies of your book? Because as we said, there's a lot more to it there. Do you have? I don't know if you do this, but I want to ask anyway. Do you have like recipes and things in your book, or is it just kind of general suggestions about what foods to eat, or is it more about understanding the background and then people can apply that themselves?
It is much more about understanding the background and the fundamental principles, and then I kind of offer things in general terms. And my thinking about it was let people kind of adopt this to some of their preferential tastes, rather than my saying you're going to have a ground beef patty at you know, for lunch today or something like that. Maybe somebody doesn't like that, or they would prefer something else. So I say, okay, well, you know, choose your protein. Every ounce, you don't want to exceed 25 grams of protein in a meal, because that triggers that mTOR pathway I was talking about. So to keep it under that threshold, you want to limit yourself to no more than maybe 25 grams of actual protein in a meal. And in each ounce of meat or fish, there is about 7 grams of protein. And so, and eggs maybe have each, an egg is going to have maybe about 7 grams. A large egg would have maybe about that much. 2 cups of nuts would have about that much protein, maybe a cup of bone broth, which by the way is an awesome thing to add to your diet, homemade bone broths.
Mm-hmm.
Also cultured vegetables, oftentimes that, you know, that you culture and ferment yourself preferably, although there are good ones you can buy, but they're just very expensive. You know, raw cultured vegetables have more nutrition, more enzymes, more vitamins, minerals, nutrients, etc., than the vegetables they came from. So that's a great addition to your diet too. Can also help with digestion and whatnot. But anyway, so by calculating out using that, you can sort of calculate your own protein needs. I offer a little bit of a formula for how to figure out how much protein you need for yourself, because it's going to be different for different people depending upon what their ideal body weight is, how, you know, how big they are to begin with.
How much they move around, what they do,
what their
right?
metabolic demands are, et cetera. Yeah. So I offer a way of figuring that out for yourself as sort of a ballpark figure to work with. So I give there's an enormous amount of information in this book. It was not written as a marketing tome. It was written to empower people with information that they could use and understand themselves and their health better. There is a cookbook out there that is basically based on my material. It's called Primal Cuisine. It was written by a woman named Polly Halstead. But there's actually something even better coming. I'm in the process right now of writing a book on this way of eating with a celebrity chef in Australia who has become incredibly passionate about this message. And we're sort of teaming up now to take this message basically all over the world. And it's going to be this marvelous sort of professional marriage between the science behind all this and understanding all this better from that perspective and giving the whys and wherefores. And this guy has recipes that are unbelievable, just mind-blowingly good. And it has made it really, really, really accessible to everybody. And so people who are interested in that, there's something, it's called The Paleo Way. You can go to thepaleoway.com. And sign up for updates on that are coming. Pete Evans is the chef's name in Australia, and you might want to look his recipes up as well, because he's done some amazing things with this, and it's all based on my material. So I think the combination is going to be really great. I'm not that much of a chef. For me to write a cookbook would put most people to sleep, because I'm happy with a hard-boiled egg in the morning.
Right.
You know, I can take a tiny little chicken thigh, a boneless, skinless chicken thigh, throw it in boiling water for 6 minutes, slather it with coconut oil, and put like curry on there and some, pepper and some garlic and whatever. And to me, that's absolutely delicious and very satisfying. And I can, run half the day on that. For people that really want to make it more interesting, to be able to generate the variety and also in ways that are going to make you miss the other way of living less. It really takes, I think, a chef to do that, and I'm just kind of like, if I'm having company over, I can do a pretty good job. when I'm cooking for myself, it's pretty, there aren't a lot of bells and whistles.
Oh, I know that. Not enough time to sit there and, do all that stuff, so you want to do it quick. That's kind of the state I ended up in. I want to get it. I mean, I hate that's a horrible thing to say, really, but it's kind of one of those things. Some days there's so much other things to do. You kind of want to get it over with, right? And to a certain extent, you don't want to spend your time like thinking and obsessing about food or being hungry. You want to eat something that lasts you for a long time, And that's why this is so great,
And I guess I didn't want to, I tend to be kind of unassuming, and I don't want to assume that the things that I think are tasty are going to be tasty for everybody else.
Sure. Yeah.
So I just sort of provided general guidelines, but I mean, you can take, and you can do a lot of things in advance. This doesn't have to, look, if a meal takes more than 5 or 10 minutes to make, I'm not interested,
Right.
In most days. But you can take and, put just a little effort into making up a big old pot of bone broth. And then you can take and on different days add different things to that and make your own unbelievably nutrient-dense, nutritious soups that are full of the marrow and full of all of the nutrients from the bone, all the minerals and vitamins and whatever have you. And then add to that little bits of ground meat or chopped vegetables or spinach or kale or something like that, and just add some seasoning, some garlic to that, some curry or whatever, and you have an incredibly nourishing and really satisfying meal. In fact, that's what I'm doing for lunch today. I brought some bone broth in that I had added some things to. And it's a really simple kind of humble meal, but it's unbelievably nourishing and satisfying at a very low cost. What does it cost to go out and buy a bunch of bones? Nothing,
right.
You go to your butcher that gets grass-fed meat in, and get those kinds of bones from them, and you'll have unbelievably high quality bone broth from that. Or you can take and do stir fries and things, or you can create stews from things. There's a lot you can do to kind of do things ahead of time. Culturing vegetables isn't that hard to do, and you can create a huge vat, a huge crock full of those that'll last you, you know, a month or two at a nominal cost, whatever that head of cabbage and whatever else you wanted to throw in there cost you, plus a little bit of time, you know. But it's so easy to make this livable. And the other thing is, a lot of people, because they crave the sugars, they crave the starch, they crave the grains, right? They think that they couldn't possibly give those things up because they just, it's unthinkable. They're craving those things all day long. Those are my favorite foods. The only reason you're craving them, other than possibly being addicted to the opiate, you know, kind of effect that a lot of these foods create, is that you're relying on sugar as a primary source of fuel, and therefore you're going to crave what you are relying on as a primary source of fuel. Once you've made that metabolic adaptation to relying on this other more natural primary source of fuel, cravings for this other stuff tends to fall away. I used to eat tons of bread. I used to eat, I used to love carbs. I used to love pasta, and I used to, you know, eat, you know, sandwiches all the time, whatever else. I ate, you know, your typical breakfast foods, your oatmeals and your, you know, whole grain pancakes and whatever else. I don't think about those things anymore. They're totally off my radar screen. Now, people, there are reasonable substitutes for a lot of these things that you can come up with that are friendly to the way of eating we're talking about. There are things you can do with nut flour that would make you weep, that are just better tasting than the original version.
Yeah, I've tried some of that. It's some really good stuff, even like, you know, with almond flour, and even coconut flour works for certain things, you know. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, hazelnut flour, all kinds of things, amazing things you can do. You can make bread from nothing but nut butter, a little baking powder, a couple of eggs, and some stevia, which is a carbohydrate, non-caloric, natural sweetener. And it will taste like the best tasting brownie you ever ate without having any bread or even any flour in it of any kind, even nut flour. There are things you can do with that.
Yeah.
But, I will admit to doing that one once in a while. But for the most part, my mind, I prefer to not seek substitutes. I kind of get that whole way of thinking about things out of my, awareness zone. I tune it out, and I'm focused on the things that would have looked like food to somebody wandering around 40,000 years ago with a loincloth and a spear or a pair of mukluks or whatever. Because I really want that to be the expectation that is set for me when I eat food. And I'm not running around looking for substitutions all the time. But there are people that feel the need for that. And there are substitutions that can be made. I prefer to get those things off my radar screen altogether, because I think that there's a little bit of a risk involved of, you know, sort of having that expectation of pancakes and of brownies and of cookies and of whatever that makes you more susceptible to falling off that wagon when you're not even thinking about it. Like, people will give me directions to their house, and they'll say, well, you know where that McDonald's is on that street right before? I'd be like, I don't even see it.
Yeah.
It's off the radar screen.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, because I don't go to those places.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, me neither. I've stopped that a long time ago.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You're a smart guy.
Oh my God. It's amazing. It takes the people still to go there. I'm still amazed. You drive by, and sometimes, and you're like, the drive-through is full of people, you know, and they keep on coming, you know. It's amazing.
There's a very interesting exercise you can do. You can either go sit and look at those drive-throughs, which it sounds like you've done, or you can walk into a conventional grocery store, you know, kind of a mass grocery store, and just stand there and look at what it is that people are putting on the conveyor belt, and look at them. Look at how what they're eating has physically impacted their health, their physical and mental health. You can see, you know, mental health in people just walking down the street sometimes. To me, there is no more obvious correlation to the ills of our society than what we've chosen to feed it. I was just in Australia, as I mentioned, on a tour, and I managed at the end of the tour to get a few days visiting the outback and spending some time around some Aboriginal people and trying to learn more about that culture and what they used to do and how they ate and all that kind of stuff. Really fascinating. It's just like a lifelong dream for me. But what I was seeing among, and I didn't have any illusions about this prior to going, it was just, you know, extra startling just being confronted with it, you know, face to face, that, you know, these people, there was a yellow flowering plant that had a nectar on it that had a, that had sweetness, that they would go and they would lick like a lollipop, you know, off its stem. And that was, you know, they would get maybe a tablespoon a year of sugar off of that. You know, there just wasn't much that they would get per year. They've gone from eating a very low carbohydrate diet. And some of the tubers that they dig up are really high in fiber. They're not real high in utilizable starch at all. Otherwise, the majority of their diet was, they really valued fat big time. You know, the fat of emus were like a major, major source of fat for the Aboriginals, as were widgety grubs, you know, these grubs that the huge white grubs, which I know sounds gross, but grubs are really rich source of fat and high quality protein. That's something our ancestors did too. Actually, we eat insects in modern times that we don't really think of as insects in the form of things like shrimp and lobster and crabs, which are insects of the sea.
Right. Yeah.
We don't think of it that way, but we're still doing that. But at any rate, and they went from this primary animal source diet to now one of eating a largely carbohydrate-based diet. And you can see where the light has gone out in the eyes of these people. And they're sitting there massively obese, the majority of them. Sitting there watching this hugely obese Aboriginal woman eating a bear claw, you know,
right
out there.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, you know, that's the real genocide here. What destroyed indigenous culture all over the world? It wasn't guns, you know. It was food.
But they don't have to do it. That's the thing, right? They have to.
But they
get themselves out of that, you know.
Right. They could if they realized that that was the issue. But you know, and Aboriginal peoples in particular have zero defense against that kind of a radical change in their diets. Agriculture for them is no more in any native culture more than 400 years, you know, or so, and in some cases half that. The last Aborigine left the land, left their subsistence lifestyle back in 1985 only. And now they're eating a Western diet. They're eating the same crap we are, only it has an amplified effect upon them. Because they have their body in physiological makeup has literally zero adaptation to a carbohydrate-based diet. And they definitely don't know how to handle immunologically grains, you know, and that sort of a thing. And right. So it's been devastating. It immediately devastates the health of native peoples and makes them much more susceptible. They're way more susceptible to things like alcoholism even than average European. For that reason, alcoholism isn't a problem with alcohol. It's dysglycemia to the extreme. The issue is extreme intolerance to sugar. And you have massive, you know, again, alcohol is like throwing gasoline on that fire. It's a very fast way of jacking up your blood sugar. And I've never met an alcoholic that wasn't a severe hypoglycemic. And what do you see at AA meetings? They're all standing around trying to mutter one day at a time, one day at a time, one day at a time, while they're smoking cigarettes, eating donuts, and drinking coffee.
Right. Yeah.
Because the fundamental issue why alcoholism and recovery from it is so difficult for the average person is that they really haven't addressed the foundational problem just by eliminating the alcohol, because alcohol wasn't the core of the problem. It was a sugar-based metabolism that their physiological makeup had no way of tolerating. And so people who switch to a more fat-based approach find that their cravings for alcohols and other simple sugars completely go away.
Interesting.
And so, which doesn't mean that you want to go back to, you know, sucking down the occasional cocktail. I know people who've rationalized that, There's a lot of bad things we can sit around and say about you know, other bad things that alcohol does to you, but that's the main issue.
Right. Yeah. 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 I think that people don't think about that, and it's a good point. And I know that alcohol has been tremendously detrimental to European culture as well. I mean, I can just think back of how this was treated in Sweden, and the people almost drank themselves to death in the 1800s. And that's partially why it led to the fact that the government took over the sales of alcohol. So you can't go out and buy liquor or wine in a grocery store today. You have to go to crawl to the government to get it. But, you know, there you go. That's so
big blessings when the government's running everything.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So that's no, but it's a really good point. And we've actually talked about alcoholism as well. This is one thing that people just kind of have to try to, you know, get out from and stop, you know, consuming. But Nora, we've gone over the time here a little bit, but it's all good. Let me get out some websites here before we wrap things up. I want to, of course, mention your primary one, which is primalbody-primalmind.com. And the two books we've been talking about is Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life. And then the last one is the new ebook that is out, Rethinking Fatigue, What Your Adrenals Are Really Telling You and What You Can Do About It. And a couple of more here, thepaleoway.com, you mentioned as well, good, the cookbook, The Primal Cuisine, coming out, and also primaltightwad.com.
Primal Cuisine has been out for a while.
It has been out. Great, great. And primaltightwad.com. I like that. I got to check that out, that site.
Primaltightwad is, yeah, and there's a link to that also on my website as well that you can find. So, but yeah, I think you can go to just Google Primal Tightwad or primaltightwad.com will get you there too. Great information for making the most optimal way of eating possible, the most affordable way of eating as well.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Nora. I really appreciate it for having you here, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Henrik. It's such a pleasure and such an honor.
That's it for today. We hope you learned something new, have something new to consider and think about. Next week, you can hear David Eberhard, Mike King, and Kevin and Benny from Joy Camp. And after that, we have Tom Goodrich, Frank Salter, John DeNugent, and others coming on. My thanks to the team, and of course, a big thanks to you for your membership. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back on Monday. Take good care, and thanks for listening.